Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren DeYoung Schulman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And we have a festive, cold December morning. We're recording just at the end of the year here, getting ready for Christmas and Christmas travel. And as a result, possibly nursing some hangovers. Ladies, what are we drinking?
I'm drinking some really sad, a combination of yesterday's reheated coffee. And then when that ran out, this is even better. You're going to love this, Erin. I added some milk and added some instant coffee and put it in the microwave. Yep.
Wow. That is sadness in a mug.
It is.
Deployment latte?
I'd wanted to get some, have some eggnog, but like that just felt like a bridge too far.
I'm amazed you didn't put like a Swiss Miss packet in there and just round it out.
Oh, that's a great idea. Next time.
Yeah.
Radha, what are you drinking?
The largest coffee that the kind folks at Starbucks would provide me, with peppermint mocha added in just for added festive flair. And I'm actually drinking it at my sister-in-law's house, who kindly provided me a quiet space to record without children who are hopped up on too much candy cane, and who is also a listener of the show. So thank you, Mary.
Great.
Thanks, Mary. That's awesome. Okay, I'm drinking some sort of green juice for my sins, because yesterday apparently all I ate was chips and guac and like pretzel Hershey Kiss. I don't think that's good for you, actually. I think that adults need actual food. I would know this.
But at least a chicken wing, I'm pretty sure.
I did have a chicken wing and some of your chili, which was delicious. So thanks for that. That's before we drank all the beer and maybe some other things.
At least a couple of shots, I'm pretty sure.
It's great. It's the holidays. We're having a super great time. And I think what we want to do here is cover a little bit of news. We're not going to do our usual bombshell segments. We're just going to give you a rundown and then switch into a little bit of year-end review. How's that sound?
Let's do it.
Perfect.
Okay. First up, we have a budget. So congratulations to all of our friends in the federal workforce. You will not be on a continuing resolution. We passed both the NDAA and the overall budget. Maybe not all of the budgets, but most of the budgets. And that's great. So congratulations to Congress for doing one of their jobs.
I mean, as a result, now every single hearing doesn't have to be all the DOD leaders saying the CR is really bad. Yes, I'm on the record saying a CR is really bad. You mean like last year when we said a CR is really bad? Yes, it's really bad.
The Congress has also passed some sort of trade deal, Radha. What's going on?
USMACA/NATO 2.0.
I love our commitment to this bit.
Yeah, it's trucking along. I believe the House gave it to the Senate. You know, Merry Christmas. And it's shaping up all right. Actually, a lot of the more contentious parts have been trimmed out, and it has some new definitions of what counts as auto, what cars are going to be counting as domestically purchased and so forth. So I think it'll certainly be useful in the run up to elections and discussions in 2020. And so there you have it. Plus, we also have an initial China trade deal.
I was going to say, do we have a China trade deal? Is it a Schrodinger's deal? Is it like asymptotically approaching a deal? Like,
I think I think asymptote is the right analogy here. It's going to never quite get to the deal, but we're certainly, the derivative is good. We have some agreement here on an initial deal. It's going to loosen up some of the tariffs. It's going to have some increased ag purchases by China. So I think it's a positive trend. It hasn't actually resolved a number of the really core issues at the center of the trade disputes with China, largely surrounding things like intellectual property. It doesn't deal with a lot of the cyber issues. So there's a lot of hanging chads left here to talk about in the future. But as an initial foray into an actual agreement that everyone admits is an agreement, which is like major progress, it's there.
So one of the things that strikes me about this, though, I mean, we've been talking obviously about China trade more or less since the beginning of Bombshell, of the podcast, from the beginning of time. It feels like that. I think we all recognize that there were some like structural issues that we needed to get resolved between U.S. and China and with regard to some, unfair trade practices on the Chinese part. But it's unclear, right? So we've levied these tariffs, we've threatened additional tariffs. To go through all of that and then not resolve the underlying issue, it's like, what leverage was actually created, and like, to what, was it just like performance art, or was there's something actually accomplished here.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of performance art. I think it did do a reset in the sense that all of the trade issues were on the table and we sort of reset back to a point where now the things left to resolve are the core issues. So if you wanted to put a positive spin on it, I think that would be it. But look, in the meantime, we've got, you know, the economy is actually trucking along reasonably well, but you've seen some increases in consumer prices. There have been some steel layoffs. So, like, I mean, there's also the broader macro trends are continuing. So it's not totally clear what the reset accomplished either economically or diplomatically. But here we are, reset.
Indeed. Meanwhile, in Northeast Asia, I guess we're also expecting some sort of, quote, Christmas present from Kim Jong-un in North Korea. I have not like followed this super carefully, but it seems that the Korea watchers are expecting some sort of missile test and essentially the collapse of our diplomatic engagement with North Korea. Am I reading that right? Is that where things stand?
I believe you're reading that right. The North Korean regime has said that the end of the year is their deadline. This has come as a bit of a surprise to folks in the Trump administration. Folks who track national security and listen to this podcast may remember that the North Koreans like to use holidays as times to test things. I guess under the assumption that we are paying less attention or just kind of like ruins things for us. I very distinctly remember my first summer at DOD over the 4th of July having a North Korea missile test. And just being shocked that they would do it then. And people are like, well, it's not a holiday for everybody, Laura. And they're like, oh, that's right. Good point. I have to ruin my holiday now. This was in addition to my surprise that like when I said things, people actually listened to me and wrote them down. And that was another moment of horror. But yeah, Merry Christmas from Kim Jong-un.
It's an interesting dynamic. I mean, of course, you know, there's been a couple of high level summits between President Trump and Kim Jong-un, and each sort of proceeding as if something was happening, but then very little actual traction with regard to any sort of disarmament, much less denuclearization by the North Korean regime. And so it's this, again, sort of this performance art of like, there's a lot like happening like at a surface level, but it's like the opposite of the duck who's like, you know, skimmy across, but like furiously paddling. There's a lot of like
it's
splashing around,
duck.
But no one's actually getting up anywhere. Yes, it's upside down. That's exactly.
And eventually
what it
it's just going to drown.
It's just, well, that's delightful image there, Rada.
Here to help bring you your holiday cheer.
So definitely, I mean, what could be better than going back to fire and fury in a presidential election year? That just sounds fraught with peril. We've also had quite a few departures or announcements of departures from senior leadership at DOD. I don't know if you guys were tracking that too carefully.
This is not actually all that crazy. It's a pretty typical thing in the last year of administration for people, if you're not going to stay through the end of that term, to leave before the beginning of that the year of the election year so that it doesn't look bad politically for the president. But as a result, nobody actually framed it that way when they announced all of these resignations. So it just looks like a whole bunch of people at DOD hate President Trump and wanted to resign en masse. There's been a number of big leadership gaps at DOD consistently throughout the course of the year. ASPR has actually been trying pretty hard to fill a lot of the non-Senate confirmed roles, like at the DASD level.
But there's actually been quite a bit of turnover at that DASD level as well, which I hadn't tracked earlier, but definitely you've got folks who basically got through their midpoint and then have rotated onward. So yes, but at the undersecretary level and, you know, at the assistant secretary level, there's quite a few gaps at this point.
There was an interesting piece the other day. I think Rada, you may have flagged this, about how the undersecretary of defense for personnel and readiness has basically been empty for longer over the last 6 years than any other position at DOD. And whether or not that position is just effectively cursed, is it even a viable job? Is it possible for one person to do the job? Or do we just hire people who are not that great at it?
Yeah, and I think, you know, for all of the general talk of people saying our workforce are our number one priority and care about our workforce, the set of people who are super enthusiastic about doing that Undersecretary of Personnel and Readiness role, which largely is a coordination of personnel policies across services and sort of commands less sort of sexy topics than, say, the Undersecretary of Policy and commands less money than, say, the acquisition side of the house, is just you know, it hasn't been a particularly popular position, with the notable exception of when there was a Force of the Future push from the secretary level. And so I think we don't know if it's too much, but it's certainly been under invested in both by administrations across both Obama and Trump, and sort of by the department itself. So we'll see if maybe in the next administration, be that another Trump administration or another Democrat, if there, that changes and there's more emphasis on it. I'm not holding my breath on that.
Meanwhile, I think there's something like currently 15 vacant Senate confirmed positions, expected to rise to 18 when these next departures take effect. And a couple more senior level, like the DARPA director is also leaving. That's not Senate confirmed, but is a pretty high level position. So, I mean, I guess it'll be interesting to see if any of those get filled. Does it continue to be acting, which we, of course, we've seen quite a lot have. You know, we spent the better part of this year with an acting SecDef who then didn't become the nominee, which was its own fascinating dynamic. So lots to kind of wait and see there. Meanwhile, we all spent a fair amount of time the last couple of weeks talking about the Afghanistan papers, which was a series from the Washington Post based on SIGAR reports, right? The Special Inspector General for Afghanistan yep. Reconstruction. There's also actually elections in Afghanistan just this weekend. It looks like Ashraf Ghani has probably won, but with very small margin, which has some implications both for trying to govern actually and build coalition in Afghanistan, but also how that might translate into a not so much negotiating position, but his ability to participate in negotiations between the U.S. and the Taliban. There's been a lot of kind of, I think, fairly meaningful reflection on the wars in Afghanistan and people trying to understand both what we collectively were doing and what we, each of us as individuals, were doing as we think about these wars. I don't know if we have any kind of final thoughts on those papers or the kind of framing of that discussion.
You know, I've been struck, and I think we saw it most recently with Millie. I think there's actually been a pretty emotional response on sort of all levels, on all sides mm-hmm. to it, with both sort of vigorous agreement and vigorous disagreement with the presentation in the Post. But I think that does go to show that, you know, I have a lot of criticisms, and I actually think the Post piece was really good. I don't think people went into these situations lightly or were, you know, really seeking to throw soldiers, Marines, airmen, sailors under fire with no cause or strategic effect. But I'm not sure that that intent really matters. So I think we're just left with a lot of strong feelings at kind of all levels and not a lot of satisfying resolution. And I guess I think Lauren has made this point, and we talked about it a little on the Syria podcast. Discussion at NatSec Girl Squad. I hope that this has an explicit conversation about this as a failure and what we can learn from it. And I guess I'm worried after all the emotional catharsis, we'll just move on and keep doing it over and over again.
I mean, I have said a lot on Twitter about this, particularly with regard to senior leader self-deception, which is not quite the same as lies, but doesn't necessarily have a better or worse connotation to it. I served in government at secretary level, principal level folks, both in 2009 and in 2014, when we were doing pretty significant reviews of Afghanistan policy under the Obama administration. And I remember very vividly in the 2014 conversation, they had a really long and what was meant to be very thoughtful strategic review should have examined a lot of these. Are our objectives actually realistic? Are they sustainable? What is a meaningful way to look at them? But the undercurrent of that long series of meetings was, stop doing all this BS, just tell me the number of how many troops that you wanted there. And that you felt this very much so from the DoD side. And that is just such a depressing thought that there was this belief that all of the strategic review was not actually real. And at the end of the day, they just wanted to know how many troops that they could have there and what they would be able to do with them. And I both understand that total depression that people were facing at that point in time, but also am really horrified by the fact that they spent what should have been 6 months of good self-reflection and they all felt like it was fake. There hasn't been a lot written about that strategic review, so I'd be curious in the future if people manage to get into the details of that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the Post obviously did a lot of emphasis on kind of framing this as you know, the secret history of the war, or that there was, you know, public testimony going on in support of the war. Meanwhile, people were telling the SIGAR that, you know, things were not going well. I don't think that that's exactly a correct characterization. The obviously been a lot of comparison between these Afghanistan papers and these reports and the Pentagon papers, which famously were written during the Vietnam War and then leaked by a RAND analyst, actually. And you know, trying to think about sort of some of the differences. And I think one of the differences is that the Pentagon papers were contemporaneous accounts. They were the contemporaneous assessments. These assessments, in particular from Doug Lute, who, of course, was an NSC staffer under both – or staffer, director under both Bush and Obama for part of these wars. These are retrospective assessments, right? And so we're not quite getting people's – we don't have documentation from 2010 and 2011 on exactly what people were thinking, although that is available, and many of us participated in those conversations and those assessments. And so I still think it's really important and meaningful, especially for someone like Doug Lute, to, you know, say, we didn't know what we were doing. It was always, you know, a real challenge versus – I mean, I guess I sort of agree with the ultimate conclusion that these if we ever knew our way, we certainly lost our way, and that we were insufficiently reflective or introspective or strategic about these wars at the time. I disagree with the framing about a secret history of the war, or that there was this, like, everyone basically knew it was, you know, complete horseshit and we sort of continued going anyway. So this is where, Lauren, your point about self-deception is really important and gets to the sort of can-do attitude of the military and actually raises really interesting civil military questions. You know, how do you get the honest assessments from folks? You know, where should it come from? Should it come from the field commander? Should it come from battalion commander? Should it come from CENTCOM? You know, none of this was operating well, and it certainly tied into some of the civ-mil dynamics, certainly in the Obama administration, which definitely had tensions at times.
I will just like one caveat on what you're saying, which is I agree with largely all of it. I do think there is this question that I have been particularly interested in that's threaded throughout related to the metrics that were presented in Congress. And I think
in which you actually, and I worked a lot on.
Yes. And I think actually the closest word that comes to that are lies. Like, those metrics were intended to present an incorrect and not meaningful picture in a way that wouldn't be perceived by people who weren't in-depth familiar with the wartime efforts. And that is terrible. It just, as we move to wars where we have these metrics, I think there we do need to start thinking more explicitly about what are the standards and criteria and accountability for what those measures are, and transparency about how they're produced and their limitations, and in the same way we do for economic and other social measures. And we just haven't done that, and that's a failing.
Similarly, the senior leaders, when they travel to Afghanistan, which they have done so many times, it's one of the like kind of the boxes that you check at some point in time if you are a senior official on a National Security Council to go over to Afghanistan or at one point Iraq. It's really difficult to actually have those visits not be a dog and pony show where you're just being fed lines over and over again. I went on one in, it must have been 2013, where we went to pretty significant measures just to throw off the schedule so we could have some non-rehearsed conversations with people. That ended up happening, like, we canceled, I think, like 6 lunches in a row in order to find one where people had not been told what to say to us. And those ended up being really useful conversations. But like those over and over again, you get a lot out of those kinds of visits just to see what things are like on the ground and the kind of work that folks are doing there and how they feel about it. But at the end of the day, they are not, they are deliberately intended to, in some ways, deceive the folks that are coming over to see it, if not just give them the best possible version of everything that's going on there, or to advocate for a particular line of action for them. They're not meant to be realistic representations of what's going on the ground. And that's a civil issue that needs to be addressed as well. Like, when you're talking to civilians, they don't want to hear the best version. They want to hear the version.
Well, that's also, you know, a dynamic. We can hopefully, you know, talk more about this in future episodes. You know, that's also, you know, field commanders versus the 5,000-mile screwdriver, right? I mean, that occurs at embassies around the world. I mean, there's all kinds of efforts. It's a classic principal agent sort of problem. But it's, of course, magnified when you have politically savvy 4-star generals and, you know, tens of thousands, if not over 100,000 troops on the ground, or, you know, 40-plus multinational, you know, coalition. There's a lot that goes on with that. But I think you're exactly right to think about, you know, how does the information flow up? This is a problem that I tried to work, you know, in greater and lesser context while I was over there and then after I got back. But I still have a lot of guilt over my, you know, my role and for not doing things differently or better or saying more about the challenges at the time. But it's I do hope it's a moment of reflection for the community and we don't get quite so lost in just the media framing. There's a lot for all of us to think about. Shifting gears, we'll just wrap up this kind of news segment here quickly. There were British elections. The Conservatives won
handily
everywhere. Labour Party was pretty handily routed, including in some very traditional strongholds in the north. It looks like people were willing to give Boris Johnson a mandate to, quote, get Brexit done, as he campaigned on. And now they have the very minor task of negotiating an extremely complicated trade deal with the EU sometime in the next 12 months.
No problem.
Okay. And then, of course, I don't know if you guys noticed this, but the House of Representatives impeached the president, just in case you missed
it. I heard something about it, although maybe he's not impeached. I mean, if you don't see the impeachment, it doesn't go to the Senate. Was there ever really an impeachment?
Right. We have some negotiations still over the Senate trial, and there continue to be revelations about the exact nature of the interactions on Ukraine policy and direction given from OMB, from Office of Management and Budget, to the Pentagon on when and how to restrict the military funding that was going to the military assistance that was going to the Ukraine. So we're still learning things. None of them are good, right? Like none of the new information comes
learning.
Out.
I think we're
we're yes. confirming priors.
Well, some people certainly already know that this is what happened. Many of them were not allowed to testify. So we're now getting this from CNN instead of the House Intelligence Committee. But, you know, not a minor detail to have the president be impeached, certainly. And not a minor detail for it to be over a significant foreign policy issue, which
right.
we continue to be, navigating. So any other news that we want to recap in the last few weeks?
No.
It's like a lot. I mean, it's a lot for December. It's like, come on, people. Yeah. Like, we're at holiday parties. We're buying presents. We're traveling. We don't have time for all of this. And yet, it never really stops. So now we want to shift gears into kind of a year-end review. And I think we'll do this maybe with a couple of categories. What stories or what topics do we want to talk more about in 2020? I don't just mean on Bombshell, although we can do that, of course. But what else in kind of the national security community should we be paying more attention to, talking about more, driving our attention in the next year?
I'll start. Immigration policy.
Yay!
We had a flurry at the beginning. We talked about the border. We talked about family separation. We had a little discussion about sending the troops there. That continued, guys. It kept going on all year. And I feel like we kind of didn't talk as much about it as we could have. The horrific family separation, the actual intents of the immigration policy. There are a number of dimensions related to also not just border, but high-skilled workers. And actually, much like trade, I think that immigration policy has a lot of sort of ties and relevance to how we think about U.S. moral leadership, about how we think about American values, as well as just like tactical questions on like, should we have police wearing uniforms that look like military when they're walking along the border? What should rules of engagement be? Should we be providing assistance to Mexico on thinking about refugees or displaced people, et cetera, et cetera? So I think there's a lot. I will try to learn more and talk more about it, but I think we should all probably be paying a little bit more attention to it.
And related to that is sort of understanding Department of Homeland Security as a national security agency, right?
Which
none
yes.
of us want to do.
But yes.
But it's true. But it's true. Lauren, what would you like to see more of in 2020?
I want to see more discussion of stories like voter suppression as a national security issue. So bear with me here. So here's what I'm thinking. Just in the last two weeks, we've seen two big stories again come out about Georgia and Wisconsin doing pretty significant voter purges. I think in the hundreds of thousands in both cases. And this is not a one-time thing. This has happened in multiple states over the last several years. And it relates to me, we talk as national security professionals a lot about the importance of having national security institutions, independent institutions like the intelligence community, like our foreign service, like our military, without thinking about the fact that a lot of these institutions both don't work for a lot of our population in the United States and are also just really, really disconnected from them. Like, and voter suppression is the most obvious and clear way in which we are disconnected. We are not allowing people who should have the right to vote in the United States to actually participate in and actively trying to prevent them from doing so. And that connection to me, like if we want to make national security something that people care about in the United States, or at least like are not actively suspicious of, we should be doing more as a community to make sure that people are involved in our democracy and in any number of a variety of ways. Voter suppression strikes me as like the clearest and obvious one. So I think you're a national security professional working on not only get out the vote, but actually making sure people are actually able to exercise the right to vote should be a national security issue that I want to hear more about, but also I think is an important issue for 2020 coming up.
That's an awesome idea. And mine is a little bit different, but I think is of a piece with these in that these are all, it strikes me as an effort to turn a little bit of the national security discussion into more of a human security discussion, which is something that I absolutely would have rejected 10 or 15 years ago.
I was going to say, security. No,
me too.
So squishy. Wow. And I didn't like the framing. Although I did have one professor tell me that when he changed his course title from like issues in national security to issues in human security, the female enrollment in the class doubled.
Wow.
So there's an interesting gender dynamic associated with that.
Yeah.
But I think part of this is just we're all seeing that there are linkages across issues that aren't just like how many like aircraft carriers should we have and, you know, what should the ascension policy be at the, you know, military academies. Mine is climate. So of all of these things, when we talk about, you know, kind of in the weeds on a particular policy discussion, it is sort of like, but there's a big Orwellian battlecruiser sitting out here while we sort of do angels on a pinhead, you know, down on Earth. And I am not good at tracking climate issues. I think they lead to a lot of immediate despair. I tend to think about them basically like William Gibson's jackpot, you know, like, but the political and economic and social implications of climate change, and I tend to agree with those who are kind of framing this as climate crisis. Like, this is happening now. Like, if you're watching what's happening in Australia, right, like a significant part of the country is on fire. Literally on fire. And the air quality in Sydney has been, you know, catastrophic for weeks now because of, you know, fires in the area. This is not something that's going to happen in the future, right? For those of us who like did debate in the 1990s and read all the climate cards, like all those impact cards are basically happening now, right? So boreal forest dieback, you know, ocean acidification, ocean warming, it's all kind of in play. And so the question is kind of what do you do, whether from an international organization, international cooperation perspective is one thing. What do you do, you know, on migration? I think a significant amount of the activity we're seeing on a number of these migration patterns, whether it's from Central America to the U.S. or Sub-Saharan Africa and Sahel into Europe, are all kind of part and parcel of this. So, you know, those of us hardened national security professionals may have to figure out how to deal with human security issues in 2020.
Not the humans.
And actual humans that, you know, are affected by our technocratic policy choices. Okay, well, that'll be fun for all of us. Let's adjust our target slightly and hear, what would you like to hear less of in 2020?
Guys, Brexit. I need less Brexit. Just do it. It's like a bad breakup that's been taking too long. They wanted to be friends with benefits. Nobody wants that. You just need to separate and everyone figure out how to cope with it. I kind of feel like we should send Nicole Cliff over to like give them some advice and move things along.
Right. This is no longer a conscious decoupling. This is just like rip the Band-Aid off, shove him out of bed.
That's right.
No breakup sex. Move on.
But they have to negotiate this trade deal. And I guess that's just probably not going to be like that interesting to watch. But there's basically still a risk of a hard Brexit 12 months from now.
Yeah, fine. Just do it at this point. Hard Brexit. If you haven't been prepping for hard Brexit for 12 months, get on it, folks.
Rada has spoken.
I'm done.
Do you think they actually have trade negotiators anymore? Remember, this is a problem like a year ago. They realized that they had no actual trade negotiators.
Who knows? Maybe. I don't. I mean, British listeners, call, you know, tweet us and let us know if you have any trade negotiators on retainer at this point.
Hey, we could send Jared over. I hear he's good at fixing things.
He really is. He and the CEO of WeWork, I'm sure they'll be great.
Lauren, what do you want to hear less of?
I know this is odd coming from me. I want to hear less about civil servants in 2020.
What?
I know. Civil servants should be, I mean, they should be like good little children and seen and not heard, really not even seen all that much. I don't want them to be the saviors of our republic. I want them to just like be able to do their job. I particularly don't want to have to get into debates about whether or not the ones who are reporting bad behavior are treasonous, or the ones who didn't report bad behavior should be, you know, kicked out in the next administration. I just want all drama about civil servants to more or less go away and move to the background and like actually focus on like the actual wrongdoing in this administration rather than what the civil servants did about it. They were apparently the tool of last resort to be able to deal with the president of the United States. I'm super unhappy about that. I don't want to hear about it anymore.
So mine maybe is also a little surprising. It's just, and it's kind of only like a partially true thing. What I would like to hear less about in 2020 is the Space Force.
But
what I mean by that is like, I don't hear like less of like the hot takes on Space Force unless they're about whether the uniforms have capes. I'm still deeply invested in that subject. Mm-hmm. But what I want to know is like, no, but really, what does it mean to have Title 10 authority for the Space Force, right? What does it mean? Are there going to be actual warfighting authorities at Space Command? Like, actually, how is this working? Who is sourcing things? What is going on? And some of the actual nuts and bolts, and not just the like generic pieces of, oh my God, a tweet became a form, you know, military policy. Now what do we do about it?
So you guys don't know this, but we're on Skype. And I'm watching Radha make a long journey inside, outside. Okay.
Okay. It's like a mix of like Blair Witch and then like a really long Scorsese tracking shot. So it's sort of incredible. I mean, one day we could like actually have a studio and have other people take care of these things for us, but then we would not be able to do this podcast in our pajamas hungover. So these are the trade-offs that we accept in life.
Yeah, we're having a bit of a problem because we have, I won't say who, but a show that is on television that is well known has asked whether or not they can film us at some point in time while recording our podcast, and we're going to have some problems if they do.
We're going to be more organized, guys.
Yeah,
2020.
Sure. I'll shower.
Sure. Okay, that's a great New Year's resolution for all of us. Speaking of not quite New Year's resolutions, but let us end this little segment with our favorite things of 2019. And let me just say that they don't have to be national security things or human security things. They could be any of the things. This year was a challenge, perhaps, for many. And so what brought you joy? What will you look fondly upon in 2019?
Guys, everyone talks about trade now. Everyone. Also, we call them trade taxes. Kai Rizdahl tweets about it. It's all very exciting. I learned how to spell tariffs with a helpful ending with FFS from Kai. Thank you very much. So overall, I feel like tariffs are national security. Trade taxes are national security issues. We're all there together. Welcome to 2020.
Similarly, mine is also that everybody talks about politicization of the military now. It's really exciting. It's become a topic that like even the military acknowledges might actually be a problem. Maybe we should do not that as much, maybe a little bit less, or at least we should talk about it more. But in a wildly different non-national security related topic, guys, the humpback whales are doing better. Like they were going extinct and it was really sad. And now the humpback whales are coming back. So that's great. If you have children that watch the Octonauts, you know a lot about sea creatures. And I am very invested in sea creatures in a way that I was not like 5 years ago in life. So yay, humpback whales. I'm so delighted for you.
You guys are going to make me feel very lowbrow about this, but my favorite thing about 2019 is The Mandalorian.
Oh.
It's also that my nieces have a phone and text me, and the 7-year-old texts me almost every morning to just like say hi and check in, even though she's like not dressed or ready for school. So like it's hilarious. But like The Mandalorian is what every Gen X Star Wars fan has been waiting for basically since 1984. And we now have it, and it's not from J.J. Abrams. It's from Jon Favreau. And it's just this like Star Wars serialized Western. And it's amazing. So that is my favorite thing of 2019 by far.
Oh, yeah. Well, now I feel bad. Like, should mine have been my second child? I had him.
Oh, shit.
He's totally my favorite thing. That's what I meant. Not trade. Skip that trade stuff.
Not trade at all.
I don't know. Like, Kai Rizdahl saying trade taxes, second child. That seems about commensurate, frankly.
That seems about right.
I mean, it's all good.
So can we talk as a just as a final pop culture thing? Rada, I know you haven't seen it, but can we talk about Star Wars for a second? Aaron and I had very different reactions.
Yes, we should. And so just spoiler. If you've not seen it, stop listening now. Lauren, proceed.
Okay. I loved it, like top to bottom loved it. I did not like The Last Jedi was fine, but I was not super invested in it. So here's why I loved it. I come to Star Wars as a 15-year-old girl who is obsessed with Star Wars and watched it every day on VHS tapes and like read fan fiction and 100% participated in AOL role-playing game chat rooms. And like the mentality with which I enjoy Star Wars is that sort of extremely nerdy, romantic, writes fantasy stories, Star Wars stories in my notebooks at night kind of attitude. I am not approaching it as a mature adult. So from that perspective, it was great. Like they, you know, Ben Solo and Rey made out at the end. Like, of course they were supposed to make out at the end for a second. And of course he was supposed to die like a second later. That was totally fine. Everything was very shallow. There wasn't a lot of character development. They didn't spend a lot of time hanging out together. You're just supposed to assume that these relationships work. That's exactly how a 15-year-old would approach these stories. And I'm absolutely great with that. The thing that I was less satisfied with was like, wait, I'm sorry, what happened to the rest of the government? Like, was there a government at any point in time in the last, like, 30 years that might have been governing the galaxy or of any kind? Like, where did they go? That part's confusing to me. But beyond that, I thought it was excellent.
Yeah, Lauren is so wrong about this. So, like, I saw Star Wars with my brother. I have taken my brother to see every Star Wars movie, including the re-releases of the originals that came out in the late 90s when he was basically a toddler. We saw the prequels together when he was like an elementary school student, and now he lives in Washington, and we've gotten to see all of the new ones together. And so, like, that is an emotionally resonant, you know, family activity for us. And I saw this movie and felt nothing. So Han Solo shows up for like 10 minutes of like random conversation with, you know, as like not as a Force ghost, but like as a Force memory. I felt nothing. So part of this is sort of, you know, I actually like The Force Awakens. I actually like The Last Jedi, both for different sorts of reasons. I did not hate The Last Jedi the way some fans did, but I did not love it for all the other reasons either. But I liked the new characters that we get in The Force Awakens, and I liked their interaction. And so what I want out of the final Star Wars is more of Rey and Finn and Poe running around the galaxy and less new Force magic. Like I want less, you know, and I want fewer Deus Ex Machina. Like, oh, look, Palpatine's not dead. Oh, look, he has a 300-ship Imperial Navy. Like there's like no reason for any of that to happen. There's also no reason for it to like fall apart the way that it does. It is like very janky plot-wise for an audience that has a lot of tolerance for janky plots. And this just was sort of, you know, we get Rey's parentage. She's a Palpatine. But apparently we don't need to talk about that for more than 30 seconds. We're just going to like pass right over it. Drove me crazy. So I guess...
Are there any cute fuzzy animals or baby
yes,
future things?
Yes. There was an Ewok.
Great.
There was an Ewok for a second. And there's a really cute little droid.
Yeah. I mean, there's like, and what's also weird is that they introduce a number of new characters. Like, I'm glad Carrie Russell is involved, but like, why does she need to be there?
Carrie
like,
Russell is involved?
Yeah.
Wow.
Weird.
Yeah, see? Exactly.
I will say, just to close out our Star Wars section and bring us all together, that I have the Star Wars edification from you all has allowed me to identify Star Wars references in everyday life and, in fact, use droids as my example of AI when we're like, AI is going to destroy the world. I was like, well, they're goods and bads. Like, don't you want some R2-D2s?
Rada,
how's that,
I'm so proud
how's that
of
working
you.
Out for you? Is that going pretty good? A little human-machine teaming in the X-Wing there?
I worry sometimes there's a lot of follow-up things that when I say things like that and people ask me questions, I one day made some kind of Blue Squadron side reference and people started saying things to me. And I was like, guys, that's 100% of what I had for you. And I'm not even sure I used it correctly. So it's dangerous. A little knowledge. It's an adventure for
me. Next time say red. Red would be better.
Well, there was a Blue Squadron. We'll come back to that. Anyway. Okay. So we are now all in the holiday spirit. Folks should definitely go and watch Star Wars and let us know whether I am right or Lauren is wrong. And then we can all, you know, kind of debate Star Wars for the end of time or alternately stop and just wait for the new Obi-Wan series with Ewan McGregor to get released on Disney Plus and agree that that's the new best thing.
Oh, I was like, and just stop because we're done forever and ever
no,
and
no.
ever.
There's too much
it
money
will never
to be
done.
Sorry.
Yes.
All right. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you again in the new year. Happy holidays.